At this forum last year, I outlined the effects of the financial crisis on the Australian securitisation market and the prospects for securitisation in the post-crisis environment. So 12 months on from that, my assessment still is the same as it was 12 months ago, namely that securitisation assists in the efficient distribution of risk across the financial system and should have a role in the financial architecture going forward. So the fundamental logic of why securitisation is generally a good thing is well understood by those in this room, certainly. Of course, as is also widely appreciated by you all, the financial crisis highlighted some significant inadequacies in securitisation practices, particularly in the US. And some of those inadequacies are still coming to light sort of day by day at the moment. This has forced participants on both sides of the securitisation market, namely the issuers and the investors, to reassess the assumptions undermining their business models. These inadequacies were absent in the Australian securitisation industry, but unfortunately the local industry has had to deal with brand damage not of its own making. This is despite the asset class in Australia continuing to perform exceptionally well in terms of rate of return. So what I want to do today is briefly recap the main changes that have affected the securitisation industry as a result of the crisis, and to review developments in the market over the past year. The main message I want to leave you with is very similar to the one I gave last year. So while it is clear that the industry will take some time to adjust to this new environment, there are sound prospects for securitisation remaining an important part of the financial landscape, albeit not at the levels seen in the heady pre-crisis period. So what this graph shows you is how much of the stock of housing credit is funded by securitisation. So you can see over the decade leading up to the financial crisis, securitisation was a rapidly growing segment of the market here as well as globally. So as a share of housing lending in Australia financed through securitisation, that rose from less than 5% in the mid-90s to over 20% in 2008. So while RMBS accounted for the bulk of securitisation activity, growth in other parts of the industry, including the securitisation of commercial property, auto and equipment loans, also grew faster than aggregate lending in these market segments. A range of factors on both the demand and supply side underpinned the rapid growth in securitisation. So on the supply side, changes in technology and the fall in nominal interest rates were important in improving the competitive position of the non-bank originators in the mortgage market. And those guys tapped a securitisation market for funding because they did not have access to the cheap deposit funding that the banks had. On the demand side, the dearth of supply of high-quality credit instruments in Australia made asset-backed securities and RMBS in particular an attractive investment for many domestic investors, particularly given the absence of the dearth of CGS and state government paper. So this domestic demand was the foundation of the market in the early days. Over time, the ability to tap international markets became an increasingly important source of demand for Australian RMBS. So what we've got here is splitting RMBS into that component which was issued offshore and that component which was issued onshore, and as you can see more recently, that part which was bought by the OFM. Now, offshore doesn't mean international, and domestic doesn't, and onshore doesn't mean domestic, given a lot of offshore investors also, but that's the currency denomination, basically. But by and large, the offshore was bought by foreign investors, and the onshore mostly by domestic, but a decent foreign investment in that too. But in particular, in terms of the offshore investment, though, offshore sieves comprised a sizable share of the international investor base. So as is now very widely known, these sieves funded themselves short and invested in long-dated assets like RMBS, a business model that was particularly vulnerable, and as it proved to be. So the reappraisal of risk brought on by the financial crisis led to demand from international investors retreating much faster than domestic demand. So you can see here those different components, splitting this up rather than by where it was issued, by who actually bought the stuff. You can see the rapid increase in foreign investor participation in the market in 06 and 07, and the very rapid decrease following that. And a large chunk of that foreign investor buying, particularly in those latter stages, was by sieves. So, as I said, the sieves were particularly hard hit by the crisis. Their funding was severely curtailed. Many of their assets turned out to be poor-performing, illiquid, or both, although obviously not their Australian stuff. Many were forced to shut down and liquidate their portfolios, in the process selling their Australian RMBS back into the local secondary market, notwithstanding the fact that the Australian RMBS was continuing to perform well. Indeed, Australian RMBS was often sold first because of its good performance, and they had to the harder stuff, the really crappy stuff, they had a lot more trouble selling. On top of this, investor demand for new issuance declined both internationally and domestically because of the brand damage of RMBS from the US in particular, where the poor lending and servicing practices there saw a material deterioration in collateral performance. The liquidation by the CIVs of their RMBS holdings, combined with the increased aversion to the product from investors because of the brand damage, saw the price in the secondary market decline significantly. Our estimate is that in Australia, yields in RMBS in the secondary market widened from around 20 basis points to as much as 450 basis points over swap. So while the secondary market spread remained this wide, there was not going to be any, or very likely to be, no interest in primary issuance. Investors could satisfy their demand much more cheaply in the secondary market. So it is well understood that as a consequence of the demise of CIVs, the investor base for asset-backed securities is substantially narrower than prior to the crisis. So one, we should not expect it to get back to that share of the market that it was in 2007 anytime soon, if ever. So, and as I said, this is particularly the case in the offshore markets. Those guys just aren't around. They're not likely to come back at all. There are, however, still natural investors, both domestic and offshore, that ought to be attracted to the high quality of the Australian RMBS. So let me talk a bit more about some recent developments. So what we've got here is the issuance year by year, split again into onshore and offshore, and then the orange bars in the last 3 years is the AOFM purchases. So RMBS issuance this year has been around $18 billion, which is higher than the $14 billion issued last year, but well below the $50 billion plus annual issuance prior to the crisis. But comparing that the issuance this year with the $50 billion pre-crisis actually exaggerates the situation. The underlying pace of housing credit growth has also slowed from around 15% per annum in 2007 to around 7% currently. So given this slowing in system credit growth, comparisons of gross issuance with the pre-crisis period are just not very useful. So an alternative benchmark is the amount of issuance required for securitisation to hold its own as a share of total housing lending. And a rough calculation suggests that today, annual gross issuance of around $25 to $30 billion would see securitisation maintain its current share of housing credit. As I said, this year, issuance is at about $18 billion with another month to come. So all of the issuance this year, with the exception of one tranche in early 2010, has been in the domestic market. The issuance has been mostly by the smaller lenders, regional banks, credit unions and originators who have had limited access to alternative funding sources. These issues have involved some degree of support from the AOFM. In fact, in total, only about just over $3 billion of RMBS issued have not had AOFM support. So in thinking about the AOFM support for the RMBS market, I believe the AOFM program has a number of advantages relative to alternative means of support. It can be easily tailored to help specific types of institutions. It can be phased out easily. The likelihood that the government loses money on its investment is very small. And there is no ongoing contingent liability to the government from providing the support. If instead a government guarantee of RMBS were provided, it would be difficult to phase out, and it creates a commitment that could generate a large contingent liability for the government. At this time last year, and into the early parts of 2010, which is about the time I was talking here last year, and I'm going to say, as I said, I'm going to say the same message that things are looking up, which I said last year. But anyhow, there were signs that the market was developing some momentum. Issuance was on an upward trend. So what I've done this time around is I've split this up into quarterly issues. So you can see there in late 2009, those quarterly bars are starting to get bigger, and about just after I gave my speech, they dropped away again. So issuance was on an upward trend, and the share taken by the AOFM, which is the red line, had declined from the very high levels seen at the start of the government's support program. There were also two issues in the first part of the year that did not have AOFM support. But conditions deteriorated in the second quarter, with credit markets generally unsettled by the sovereign debt concerns in Europe, which is what's happening right at the moment, obviously, but anyhow. In response to these difficulties, the OFM adjusted the pricing of its cornerstone RMBS investments in May, with the express purpose of making securitisation a more competitive source of funding for small players in the mortgage market. So what we've got here is the red dots are the spreads on the primary issuance. The yellow dots are the spreads on issuance, the spread of the AOFM-supported issues, and then the purple line is our estimate of the break-even, taking into account the mortgage rates and the mortgage rate that people are able to write mortgages at, as well as the total cost of putting together the security. So prior to May, private investor bids were only just inside the range, which made deals competitive for issuers. So if you see in that red dot in middle of 2010, it's only just inside we reckon break-even was. So the AFM started buying longer-dated tranches at a spread of around 110 over swap. Private investors in these deals bought the shorter-dated tranches, often at a spread that was around 100 over. As a result, average issuance costs for senior notes declined from around 140 basis points to close to 100 over. This tightening in primary market spreads has seen the volume of issuance pick up in the second half of the year. Although the AOFM has increased its share of issuance, private investors have nevertheless taken around two-thirds of issuance since May. There's also been a gradual lengthening in the average maturities of tranches taken up by private sector investors and some sale of first loss tranches. The cost of the recent Bank West deal that priced without AOFM support and included the soft bullet structure to attract investors also suggests some improving appetite on the part of investors. So while it's difficult to get a precise estimate of secondary market pricing, it appears to have remained broadly stable over recent quarters, still much wider than prior to the crisis, but well below those peaks of 450 basis points in sort of 08 and early 09. So if you look at where RMBS is pricing relative to other fixed income products, you can see that the widening of RMBS spreads was generally larger and hasn't come back as far as it has for other fixed income asset prices. So it's difficult, given the very strong historical performance of Australian mortgages and the underlying collateral, not to review this relative pricing as somewhat anomalous. So, for instance, you've got banks issuing 3-year unguaranteed there at quite a narrower spread than RMBS. RMBS is backed by a security. The 3-year issue is unsecured funding, anyhow. So some of that, I think, reflects the legacy of the brand damage the crisis inflicted on mortgage-backed securities and is a measure of the work still to be done by the industry to restore investor confidence and improve liquidity. There is, of course, a good story to tell about the Australian mortgage market, which is that the arrears rates on Australian mortgages have remained at a low level and are well below the arrears rates in many other countries. So you can see where the orange line right down there at the bottom, with only the light blue line, with only the Canadian market being anywhere comparable to the Australian mortgage market's performance. But the state of the securitisation market in Australia is obviously by no means unique, as I believe you heard earlier this morning, with issuance in other markets also sluggish. Credit markets globally still remain cautious, with the sovereign debt concerns in the second quarter tempering investor appetite, and we'll have to see what the sovereign debt concerns currently are going to do. For example, issuance in the RMBS market, and I think you saw this graph a bit earlier in the day, was particularly weak in the early part of the year but has seen a modest pickup in activity more recently. And one promising development there has been the pickup in offshore issuance by UK originators, particularly, obviously, by Lloyds, who you heard from earlier. A constraint on the offshore issuance more specific to the Australian market has been the influence of the cross-currency basis swap, which has widened a reasonable amount as well, which has made offshore issuance even relatively more expensive than it has for onshore issuance. And as a significant share of the issuance to offshore investors was in foreign currency pre-crisis, that has tended to reduce the appetite for offshore issuance post-crisis. So what I've tried to do today, and just by way of wrapping up, is to provide a recap of the state of play in the Australian RMBS market. As I said last year, and I'm going to say it again this year, and hopefully it'll be a little bit better in terms of forecasting, the market is slowly returning to life. And I believe that that securitisation will again provide a useful role in the provision of credit in Australia. But, as I've said a few times today and as I've said a number of times in the past, securitisation is not going to return to its pre-crisis share of the market anytime soon. I look forward to discussing the policy issues surrounding the market with my fellow panel members shortly.
Guy, can I bring you in at this point? You did mention that you were very supportive of what the AOFM had been doing for the securitisation market here. And the bank, of course, itself has been involved, particularly through the crisis. Do you have a view that you're prepared to share with us about whether there's more that the bank could do or should do? And I say this against the background of some recent remarks I've read by Charles Goodhart, a very well-known international scholar of central banking, who actually began, well, has written to the effect that, in his view, central banks should widen the range of functions that they perform going forward, and one of them actually is to facilitate structural funding shortages in financial systems. Is that something you think the RBA could and should do?
Sorry, no,
funding shortages. Well, effectively supporting things like securitisation is how I read that.
Okay, well, I mean, we take all AAA rated securities as eligible collateral in our operations. We are not going to buy an outright exposure. That's not the way we should be committing our balance sheet. That's ultimately a decision for the government, which is why the AOFM is the appropriate vehicle to be doing that. You know, we are, but nevertheless, the asset class, as I said, we support through providing some liquidity through our repo facility.
Yeah. Am I right in saying, Guy, that the bank only requires a 10% haircut on those securities, whereas APRA wants a larger haircut?
We're talking about different things here. Okay. We are talking about the risk to our balance sheet from the security. So, what we're doing is a set, and amongst other things, this stuff is not with us for particularly long.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a reasonably short-term exposure. So I don't think the two things are actually all that related. We do take a 10% haircut on RMBS, which is bought into us as collateral. That's correct. But as I said, we're looking at from our point of view, the transaction's a lot different, I think, than it is from APRA's point of view.
Right. So I gather that the banks engage, the rest of the involvement, to the extent that it occurs, should occur through the AOFM, through the government, rather than the bank.
Well, so ultimately, we're not in there to purchase these exposures outright.
Yep.
That's a decision for the government to take.
Yep.
If it wants to, which it has decided to do so, and it's done it and doing it through the AOFM, is perfectly appropriate. And we're there to support the liquidity in the market, to meet liquidity needs of financial intermediaries. We are not in there to underwrite an asset class.
Guy, would the Reserve Bank have a preference for covered bonds over RMBS as instruments for repo?
I mean, repo criteria is solely in terms of the quality of the asset. So, effectively, they're the same asset underneath it.
Right.
So, in fact, covered bonds actually gives you slightly more, as Graeme said, slightly more recourse. But, I mean, the other issue to consider, there are a couple of other issues to consider here as well, I think. One is, when thinking about covered bonds, particularly if you're an ADI who has a lot of unsecured paper already out there, if you come along and suddenly introduce covered bonds, you've just subordinated your whole investor base. Now, they may be completely happy with that, but my guessing is not every single one of them is going to be completely happy. They've suddenly just been subordinated. So it's not just depositors, I think, you have to think about. It's also the unsecured credit holders. Now, that doesn't mean that there's... by no means am I saying there's no role for covered bonds here, but I just think before everyone thinks that covered bonds are suddenly the magical solution to all this, there is the whole other part of the funding base, which you've just suddenly subordinated, and also in this case unexpectedly suddenly subordinated. Those guys, when they bought that paper originally, it wasn't on the undertaking that they're suddenly going to lose claim on 10% of the balance sheet, say. So I think that's something one has to think about before one rushes too headlong into that. That said, as you mentioned, at the moment there is the barrier of the Banking Act and depositor preference. The financial claims scheme is currently under review. It needs to be finalised by October, hopefully a fair way in advance of October. New arrangements being put in place around that, which will clarify some of these issues around depositor protection. But as Graeme said, and even from a rating agency's point of view, there will be a limit on how much you'd be able to use covered bonds as a funding source if they were allowable, in the sense, again, I'm both undermining the rating of the unsecured credit holders as well as undermining the ability to make depositors whole.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ian. I just wanted to ask the whole panel to comment more about what's the missing infrastructure in our market. Because I agree with Greg somewhat in terms of that maybe instead of throwing more money at the problem, maybe we've got to think about what the missing bits of our capital markets that can be built to facilitate more liquidity, more turnover and more issuance. And Greg touched on this fixed rate issuance that is attractive to a part of the fixed income market, but it doesn't necessarily suit the asset class because we've got an amortising collateral base that... so you've got a sort of a mismatch in terms of the funding and the underlying collateral. So, is there a hybrid between, on one end, using securitisation to issue fixed-rate bonds, but in some respect using covered bond technology at the other end, but still retaining that sort of depositor senior ranking and allowing substitution to cater for amortisation but not credit loss?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of, in these claims that, we just need to get it into the fixed rate index and there'll be a bunch more people there to buy it. I mean, to some extent, I think if the demand was there, you can do that already. If I'm a large bank, I've got plenty of balance sheet to be able to, and to some extent you can say, well, the Bankwest deal was sort of reflective of that. I've got plenty of balance sheet to be able to absorb. I deal with maturity transformation every single day if I'm in a large bank. So structuring a security as a bullet security, I can do that perfectly easily and deal with the cleanup in 5 years' time if it's a five-year bullet. So it strikes me that if the demand is really there, there are institutions out there who can already meet that demand. If you're a small institution, yes, it's more difficult. But if you're a large institution, you can already meet that. So it seems to me that though, there are aspects of the... I'm still not sure that how much more really needs to be done. And it's more, it's a question of time and evolution. Because a lot of the structures which are talked about, they can be done now without any more support than is already there. And... it may be a question of just talking to the investors and getting a better sense. But I don't, to some extent, I think that should be going, that's going on all the time. And I don't understand, if the investors really want it, they'll be asking for it.